Well, just a couple of notes before we kick off. Once again, books on the topic of this series are on sale after the service. And I recommend The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. There's a teenage version, there's a kids version out there. The Reason for God by Tim Keller I also highly recommend. And I recommend buying two copies of one of those books and giving one to a friend, perhaps a skeptical friend, and reading it together and sitting down when you're halfway through and when you're at the end. And that's what I do, and it's a great thing to do for everyone who does it. And so books are on sale for either $10 or $20, and there's other books out there as well, which are very helpful. I note as well before we start that next week our topic is science and Christianity, science and faith. Arnold Sickema, a professor at Trinity Western University, will be preaching, and then after the service you'll be invited to grab a cup of tea for 10 minutes and then come back in here and there will be a panel discussion with Arnold and Jürgen Rose and Tim DeYoung. So we can fire questions at them, and that will be very interesting. I've got 1,000 questions that I want to ask Christian thoughtful scientists. And so that will be very, very interesting. So it's a panel after the service next week. But our topic for today is, how can God exist in light of all this suffering? And it was a question that I was asked as an older teenager in senior school by my friend Jason Richards, who I began this whole series telling you his story. He used to ask me back when I was 16, 17, how can you believe in a God who would allow all this suffering? And boy, I found that a hard question and still do in a way. But perhaps more seriously again, though that was very serious for Jason, Simone de Beauvoir, she was a French writer, and she lost her faith during the Second World War. And she lost her faith in a God who would care and who would love. And she was never incarcerated in concentration camps, but she writes of seeing trains loaded up with Jewish people headed for concentration camps, and she knew where they were headed. And she wrote, I quote, "It's easier for me to think of a world without a creator than to think of a creator loaded with all the contradictions of the world. It's easier for me to think of a world without a creator than of a creator loaded with all the contradictions of the world." And I was struck by myself 2 years ago when, just before we came to Canada, I did regularly ran a chapel service for atheistic students, high school students, with their atheistic teachers in an Anglican school, which is kind of so-called Christian school, but not really a Christian school. And the way I would run this chapel service is to have an open question time. It was almost like a grill a Christian. You can ask me whatever you want and push as hard as you like. And whether students or teachers, the question that unrelentingly came up was, how can there be a God in light of all this suffering? So in my own life, through discussion after discussion with person after person, I slowly developed for myself a four-point response to the question. And what I'm going to do now, fairly briefly, is to share with you this four-point response. And I just want to say up front that this doesn't say by any means everything there is to say about suffering. It's not a comprehensive theology of suffering, by no means. What I'm going to give now is simply the answer that I give when I'm challenged with this very difficult question by a skeptical friend or a struggling friend. And you might find it, A, helpful in your own walk, and B, you might find it helpful in your own speaking to others. So here are the 4 points that I make, and you might want to jot them down, you might want to take some notes so that you can repeat it or listen to it online as well. Number one, much of the suffering of humanity is at the hands of humanity. That's a very important point to make. A lot of the reason why there is suffering is because people are cruel to one another, and God can't be blamed for that. Number two, the fabric of creation is corrupted by human sin. And I'll explain this in more detail in a minute, but that the sin of humanity corrupts and distorts and pollutes not just our own lives, but creation itself. And so there's the suffering at that point as well. Point three, the testimony from the majority world. In the majority world, where there's deep-seated suffering, long-term structural suffering, poverty, injustice, atheism is virtually unknown. Whereas in our culture, where that structural suffering is not the same, is where atheism thrives. And then point four, that the death of Christ puts an end to suffering. That in the Christian worldview, God himself suffered to end suffering. So they're my four points in a nutshell. Now what I'm going to do is to explain each of those points in turn in a little bit more detail, and then at the end I'll come back and summarize those four points again. And again, you might just like to jot down enough so that you can store it in your mind. So point one, how can God exist in the light of suffering? Much of the suffering of humanity is at the hands of humanity. And this is very, very significant. My friend had come to Christ, and I was at Kylie's house, and Kylie's husband, Dave, didn't know Christ. And David challenged Kylie and me, and he said this. He said, how can God exist with all this suffering in the world? And Kylie just said to David, she said, most of the suffering that people experience is because people are cruel to one another, she said. And she turned to her husband and she said, and you can't blame God for that. And he took the point, more or less. And I think my friend Kylie is absolutely right. There was a very important book that was brought out in 1999, and it was called The Encyclopedia of Genocide, and it was tracing the suffering of the last 100 years. It was edited by Israel Charney, and I'm going to quote to you from The Encyclopedia of Genocide. Have a look at this. In total, during the first 88 years of the century, almost 170 million men, women and children were shot, beaten, tortured, knifed, burned, starved, frozen, crushed, or worked to death, burned alive, drowned, hanged, bombed, or killed in any other of the myriad ways governments have inflicted deaths on unarmed, helpless citizens and foreigners. Depending on whether one has used high or more conservative estimates, the dead could conceivably be more than 360 million people. It is as though our species has been devastated by a modern black plague. And the Encyclopedia of Genocide makes the point that if we are to think that us Westerners from apparently peaceful nations are off the hook, think again. It's precisely Western colonialism and Western trade policies that produce the kind of economic and political instability that makes genocide possible. So in response to the question, how can God exist with all this suffering, the first response, I think, is the majority of suffering is at the hands of other human beings. And this is a point that drives straight through the core of the biblical story, from front to back. And so in Genesis chapter 4, just quickly flick to it, if you will, just to make this point, and see that this is genuinely a theme of the biblical story. What is the first thing that happens after the fall in Genesis chapter 3. From your memory as you turn up, what happens in Genesis chapter 4? What's the first thing that happens after the fall? Cain kills Abel. Fratricide. Brother kills brother. And that's no accident. It's there to make the point that it's humankind that is making this world a misery. Or flick, if you will, to Revelation chapter 6. Turn to this. It's worth turning to these places in the Bible, because then you remember it and you get a feel for your Bible, you get to know your Bible. This is so important for us as mature Christians. As you turn to Revelation 6, let me contextualize it. We've seen a couple of times in Revelation 5 that the Lamb is worthy to open the scroll. Remember that. It's the Lamb. And that's such an exciting thing in heaven. The Lamb is worthy to open the scroll. And the scroll stands for God's history for the world, his redemptive plan for this world. And it's the Lamb, Jesus Christ, who is able to unravel and open up and realize that history. That's Revelation 5. God's got it secured. Then we come to Revelation 6, and we're going to read from verse 1, and just to give you a heads up, this is where that phrase, the four horses of the apocalypse, comes from. We meet the four horses now that cause destruction on earth. Revelation 6, verse 1, I watched, John says, as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, come. I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Here's the first horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. Now here's the second horse. Verse 3, when the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. And watch this. Its rider was given power, see this, to take peace from the earth and to make men slay one another. To him was given a large sword. And so as this scroll unfurls, while Christ has secured history, humankind will conquer and humankind will slay one another, and war and destruction is a terrible thing. Eugene Peterson said this. I thought this was a very helpful quote. He says, with Revelation 6 in mind, war is a red horse, bloody and cruel, making life miserable and horrid. And this is the first and most important reason, I think, why there is suffering. Humankind make one another's life a misery, and the Bible condemns it, and Christ has secured a future for the world in spite of it. Now, when I'm talking to people one-on-one or in certain contexts, I won't necessarily go to all these Bible verses. I'm going to the Bible verses because I know that you'll be interested in them. So here's the second point. It's a little bit more complicated perhaps, but it's very, very important. That the fabric of creation is corrupted by human sin. And this is the cause of suffering. We just have to realize, I think, and I find that atheistic Westerners are happy to grant this point soon enough in my own conversations with people, that our sin and our selfishness and our consumerism, it doesn't stop with us. It distorts the rest of creation. And then I always say, only an individualistic Westerner would think that our sin doesn't affect the world. Other cultures, as we know, testify to the interconnectedness of the world. Our sin pollutes the world, it corrupts the world, it distorts the world's goodness, and this causes suffering, whether it's droughts or earthquakes or floods. Human suffering is caught up in the suffering of the world. It's a broken world, not just a broken humanity. And I shared this at I remember once at that school I described you to, full of very, very skeptical atheistic teachers and students. And then a student, a very bright year 8 student, put up his hand, Nicholas was his name, and he said, what do you mean by that? What do you mean that our sin corrupts the fabric of the world? He was a very intelligent, young, non-believing, wonderful fellow. And so I said this to Nicholas. I told him the story of my friend Jim, who just after World War II, is an Australian, and just after World War II, he went to Germany to work in the area of Belsen. And you'll recognize that name for Belsen concentration camp, where so many thousands of people were killed. And he worked in Belsen rebuilding that township. Now, I should just say that in Belsen concentration camp, thousands of people died. 20,000 Russian prisoners of war, 50,000 Jewish people. And when Belsen was liberated in 1945, this is kind of an unbelievable thought, but 13,000 unburied bodies were found there. And Jim said, and I said this to Nicholas, Jim said to me that the area around Belsen, the area was covered, it was populated with animals, and birds would fly around. It was alive, the area of Belsen. And Jim said, and Jim's an atheist himself, but he looked at me very seriously. He said, but inside the gates of Belsen, there were no animals, and no birds ever flew overhead. And the point is, our sin and our selfishness doesn't stop with us. It distorts the rest of creation. Things are interconnected, and this causes suffering. And it's worth going to the Bible about this. If you just flick now backwards to Romans chapter 8 this time. Romans chapter 8. And Romans chapter 8, while you turn to Romans 8, I'll just give you a context. The first half of Romans chapter 8 is speaking about the Spirit that those who are in Christ have. The Spirit's in us. And the Spirit, this is very significant for what we're about to read, the Spirit is testifying to us about the redemption of creation. The Spirit is a deposit guaranteeing for us that Christ has the end secured. It's a Spirit of the new age, of the new creation. And then we read, if you'll turn to verse 18. Paul says, with his future glory in mind, verse 18 of Romans 8, and we're thinking about the distortion of creation, the corruption of creation, the way that sin catches all of creation up in its misery. Verse 18, I consider, Paul says, that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. So speaking about what Christ, when he returns, will do. Then he says, look at this, very important. The creation waits. See that? The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it. In the hope that, and see this, verse 21, the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. For we know, Paul says, and you'll recognize this, that the whole creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth right up until the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we await eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. So creation groans in bondage to decay, and we ourselves therefore groan. All of creation is caught up, and that is a part of the suffering. The fabric of creation is corrupted by human sin. Now, just before we leave this point, just flick back with me to Genesis chapter 3. We'll go back to the beginning once again. And just to note this theme again, and just so we get to know these important parts of our Bibles, Revelation chapter 3, and of course it's about the fall, Revelation chapter 3, Genesis chapter 3. Genesis 1 and 2 is creation, Genesis 3 is the fall. And just have a look at verse 17. To Adam God said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Now have a look at this, verse 17. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. And see verse 18. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground. So the whole of creation is caught up in the iniquity, the pollution of human sin. Here's a third point that I make, having spoken about that. The majority world testimony. So let me just expand on that so you can understand what I mean. While in the West, this is a very important point, I think. While in the West, it's common to doubt the existence of God in light of human suffering. In the majority world, and the majority world means outside the West. The West is called the minority world, the majority world's outside the West. In the majority world, where there's deep-seated, long-term structural suffering, atheism is very, very rare. So these places where structural suffering is rife due to poverty, due to difficult climate, due to colonialism, God is believed in. This is very, very significant, I think. This is a very, very significant point, and it begs the question, do we need to change our paradigm? So let me give you some statistics on this. And as I was kind of thinking about this and researching this, I chatted to a senior scholar, a missiologist, and I said, can you give me some stats on this so that I can tell Willoughby Church about the statistics regarding belief and unbelief in the first world and the two-thirds world? And then the scholar said this. He said, there's no point looking for statistics, he said, because everyone in the majority world believes in God. And I looked for statistics anyway, And just to show you, in Africa today, it's 49% Christian, 41% Muslim, and 9% traditional. And the remaining 1% is made up of, well, there's some Jewish, there's Hindu, there's some others as well. Atheism is a fraction of 1%. And if you just grab the next slide here, you can see the predominance of religion in the majority world, the popularity of religion in the majority world, by looking at this fascinating graph of where the church is to be found. And if you can see 100 years ago in 1900, less than 20% of the Christian world was in the non-West. The bottom dark portion is the non-West, and the top light portion is the West. So the graph is speaking about where the church is. Is the church in the West or is the church in the non-West? And in 1900, the church was in the West. Over 20% of Christians were in the West. And today, you can see on the right-hand side of the graph, 65% of Christians are in the non-West. The minority of Christians are in the West. And this, I suppose, is another indication of the popularity of religion in the non-West, in the majority world, among other things, such as a terrific work of the Holy Spirit in the majority world. But this is very, very significant, because it would seem that in the face of human suffering, rather than doubting the existence of God, people in the majority world turn to God. Yet it is common in the West, in Canada and Australia and other places, to doubt the existence of God in the light of suffering. And this, I think, should cause us to question, is our Western worldview out of shape? That in the faith of human suffering, we become atheists. If those who experience structural suffering turn to God, is it possible that in turning away from God in the face of suffering, we are exposing a deep error in Western thought? Perhaps it's showing our obsession with individual lives and individual rights in the West, rather than seeing the world as a corporate whole with a deep need of God. And I find this a very, very powerful argument when I'm talking to my skeptical friends. Frankly, if the parts of the world where there is deep long-term structural suffering almost entirely believe in God, I think that those places where there is deep suffering known have a moral right to pronounce something about the truth of the world that trumps the privileged West, in my opinion. And that's a very powerful argument in my conversations. And I just note this before we go on to our fourth point, that certain aspects, this is another very important point, West and non-West, there are certain aspects of our faith, of Christianity, that are abhorrent in the West. In some circles, if you talk about sin in Canada, you sound like a fundamentalist and a wowser and irrelevant. But in African culture, sin is perfectly comprehensible. And the Reformed doctrine of original sin, that idea that sin is inherited through the generations from Adam, again, an absurdity in the West. And I've read atheists just scoffing at it, like Richard Dawkins. It is perfectly, and I'm quoting here from Durnus, which is his book, Reading the Bible from the Majority World, Reading the Bible from the Third World. Sin is perfectly comprehensible to an African. And another thing that's perfectly comprehensible in Africa is the need for Christ to come and restore. It's a very important point, I think. Here's my fourth point. The death of Christ. How can God exist in light of human suffering? The Christian worldview offers, in light of all we've said so far, that God himself suffers to put an end to suffering in the death of his Son, so that there is hope. And this is something distinctive about a Christian worldview. And the Bible teaches that all the muck and filth and selfishness and consumerism and greed and anger and hate and impurity and pride and envy in you and me, Christ took upon himself. And all the brokenness of the world and the hurt and the tears and the starvation and the climate change, Christ carried. He carried the lot to the cross. And there Christ died, crying, "Father, my Father, why have you left me?" So that you and I may never cry those words. And Christ rose as the first fruits of the renewed world. With Christ's resurrection, new creation has begun. This is a wonderful part of Christianity, a wonderful gift of the biblical story. And along these lines, Nicholas Wolterstorff writes in his very significant book, A Lament for a Son. And Nicholas Wolterstorff, his son died aged around 23 from memory. And this book, A Lament for a Son, is just a reflection on life and the world and the Bible in the light of his tremendous grief in the death of his young adult son. So this is what he writes. How is faith, it's almost like a prayer, how is faith to endure, O God, when you allow all of this scraping and tearing on us? You have allowed rivers of blood to flow and mountains of suffering to pile up, sobs to become humanity's song, all without lifting a finger that we could see. You have allowed bonds of love beyond number to be painfully snapped. If you have not abandoned us, explain yourself. We strain to hear. But instead of hearing an answer, we catch sight of God himself, scraped and torn. Through our tears, we see the tears of God. A new, more disturbing question now arises. Why do you permit yourself to suffer? So my fourth point in answer to the question, how can God exist in light of suffering? The Bible teaches that Christ died and rose again to end suffering. So there's hope. Well, they're my four points. Just a couple of extra thoughts that kind of dovetail off this fourth point. And I kind of share it from Christian to Christian, you know, just to be a little bit more comprehensive with our answer. But a relative of mine who was struggling with this question, just struggling with the question of the suffering of the world as a Christian. And so the relative, she asked Bob Goodsward, how can God put up with all this suffering? Now, Bob Goodsward, some of you know, he's a Reformed, Dutch Reformed thinker, an economist in the neo-Calvinist direction. He's Hwan Kim's hero. We farewelled Hwan Kim last week. He's a brilliant, brilliant economist. And Bob answered my relative like this. He answered with two promises from God. Number one, God promises to be with us in suffering. And second, God promises to purify us through suffering. When I heard that God promises to be with us in suffering, I thought of that wonderful verse in Matthew 28:20, "Surely I will be with you to the end of the age." And when I heard Bob too that he said that God promises to purify us through suffering, I thought of Psalm 119 verse 71, where the psalmist with such wisdom says, "It was good for me to be afflicted so that I may learn your decrees." So I kind of finish with a poem here by Ian Keast, who's an Australian friend of mine, an English teacher. And he writes, "So much around us and honestly in us is against the grain and out of joint. Things are not as they should be. So it comes to this, that at the heart of the matter is a carpenter who takes gnarled, knotted, grainy wood and who then saws and shaves, chisels and reshapes with the grain to restore shalom." So how can God exist in light of all this suffering? I've made four points, and you might want to try and remember them for yourself if they ring true for you. Number one, much of the suffering of humanity is at the hands of humanity. Number two, the fabric of creation is corrupted by human sin, and this causes more suffering. Number three, the majority world testimony, which is, in the light of suffering, God is believed and hoped in rather than denied. And number four, that in the Christian worldview, in the biblical story, God himself suffers to put an end to suffering. I finish with a wonderful paragraph from John Newton. John Newton wrote the wonderful hymn Amazing Grace. And John Newton, you will know, I'm sure, was a slave trafficker. He captained a ship that transported slaves. And so in light of that previous terrible vocation, he wrote, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me." But in this paragraph, he's reflecting on suffering. And he's reflecting on suffering in light of what Christ has in store for us, and what Christ has in store when he comes and when he renews this world and gives us a new world in his presence. And I love this paragraph. Hear what John Newton has to say about suffering and life as a Christian. "Picture life as a journey to receive a great inheritance. Always think of life like this. Suppose a man was going to New York to take possession of a large estate, and his carriage should break down a mile before he got to the city, which obliged him to walk the rest of the way. What a fool we should think him if we saw him wringing his hands and blubbering out all the remaining mile, 'My carriage is broken. My carriage is broken.'